Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. What's your current state of mind on whether President Trump should sit down with him, with Mueller?
Well, there are two perspectives. If I'm on his criminal defense team, I would be very concerned.
Why?
First of all, I don't know what President Trump knows, but there have been a number of guilty pleas. Some of those guilty pleas go to false statements. So I would just be cautious with respect to the president's duty. The other perspective I have is he is the president of the United States, and I think that carries with it an obligation to cooperate with duly authorized federal investigations.
Today's guest, Ken Starr. Starr is one of those very few people in politics who really doesn't need an introduction. You know who he is. You know what he's famous for, what he'll always be famous for. All you need to do is hear his name, and it conjures up all those memories of the 1990s, the Clinton investigation, Monica Lewinsky, the Starr Report. It doesn't feel like 20 years ago to me. Does it feel like 20 years ago to you? I mean, especially not with everything going on now, where there's another president facing a special counsel, a president whose team is doing its own spinning and delegitimizing of the investigation, where it's become more of a political issue than a legal one. There aren't a lot of people on Earth who can have a real window into what Bob Mueller's life must be like day to day. But Starr does. Or at least he's come close. He's been there. He's lived it. And as you'll hear, he'd actually be interested in talking to Trump about all of it and maybe getting involved again. And now he's written a book about it called Contempt. Suffice to say, he is not full of warm feelings toward the Clintons, nor any reconsideration. It did strike me how much he talked in the book and in our conversation about being impressed by Bill Clinton's political skills and by him as a person, as you'll hear us talk about. But Starr is a man who has a sure sense of what's right, and he was sure then that he was right, and he is sure now that he was right. His thoughts about President Trump are a little more complicated. This is a good one, a different one, and one that I'm really glad we were able to do as Starr and his wife came through town as part of the D.C. swing of his book tour. And of course, we talked about Brett Kavanaugh, who was on Starr's team investigating Clinton, and whom he stands by completely with the allegations that are there. You'll hear the logic he uses for that and how it tracks with his sense of what happened with Clinton. Should note here, we did this interview last week when Dr. Ford had already come forward, but before we'd heard from the woman alleging the incident while they were in college at Yale. Meantime, subscribe to make sure you're the first one to get the episodes coming up, including soon with John Kerry. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover and email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Ken Starr. This all happened 20, 25 years ago. Are you surprised at how immediate and present it still feels?
It's remarkable the number of echoes that we're hearing. I said, oh, yeah, that sounds like something that happened in the 1990s. Obviously, impeachment right at this moment, conversations of Brett Kavanaugh in a very interesting context. But yeah, it has a currency that has been affirming. That is, when we read David McCullough on history, we're learning something about ourselves, not just the historical experience. We're learning about our culture, as I tend to look at the world through a constitutional lens. We're learning about our structure of government, how the structure operates. And the book ultimately is, yes, my inside story. We nearly indicted Hillary Rodham Clinton, or nearly sought her indictment. And we felt that Bill Clinton was guilty of financial crimes in Whitewater, but we chose as professionals not to seek those charges because we didn't have it. Well, that's history, right? But then move forward to impeachment, and it sounds like the talk of today.
And even just without it connecting to anything that's happening with the current White House and the current president, I think a lot of people would feel like it was almost yesterday, which maybe is about like the way that our consumption of media has changed or how big an event it was. But to think that it was 25 years ago when you were brought on, to me, doesn't seem right.
Yes, it is.
I was much more distant from you from it than you were.
Oh, yes. You were a child, but this is, again, a reminder that we are steeped in our history as much as we now rely on instant information, our iPhones, and so forth. Nonetheless, we are products as a culture, as a society of where we have been in the historical experience, and this was a part of that experience. So I felt it was time to reflect on the experience, especially when Hillary lost the election, to my surprise, and obviously to the surprise of a lot of people, the timing was such that with 20 years coming up, with my not raining on President Hillary's parade, I could write, reflect, and do that, which I'd been encouraged to do for years.
Yeah. You were going to write this book now, no matter what, no matter if Hillary Clinton had been president, Donald Trump had been president?
I would have had, it would have been, as we say in the law, a factor counseling restraint if she had won the election, because whether I voted for the president or not, I want our president to succeed. It's a dangerous world out there, and our president needs to have the support of the American people, even if we did not vote for her or him. That's my old-fashioned view. So I might have joined a law firm a little bit earlier than I did. So I decided, no, let's postpone plying the trade, going back to the farm, so to speak, putting my hand to the plow of the law, and let's do this. It needed to be done. It needed to be said, especially because the American people profoundly misunderstood why the Monica Lewinsky investigation came to be. By way of simple example, there was a misunderstanding or lack of understanding, totally understandable, that there were all these criminal convictions in Arkansas, and that Arkansas really had a huge issue with its political culture and, frankly, corruption within that culture.
What is the answer to what you did in the voting booth on Election Day?
You're going to ask. We have the Australian secret ballot. No, I did vote for President Trump.
Because
I knew I couldn't vote for Hillary. It could not be. It was not a fit of pique or you bear a grudge or whatever the usual kinds of nostrums might be. But I'm a limited government kind of person. and I felt on the merits that I would likely disagree with her policies.
So you voted for a Republican over a Democrat, not against Hillary Clinton or for Donald Trump, essentially, is what, right?
Yeah. To be honest, I struggled with whether I could vote for Donald Trump or whether I should simply follow the weekly standards lead and not vote for the I always vote, but just leave that blank. I did not seriously consider voting for a third-party candidate.
Let's talk about some of what the president has had to say about you. Most of it seems to be in two tweets that he did in February. I'll read them. He was watching you on Maria Bartiromo on Fox and quoted you saying, "We've seen no evidence of collusion. I have seen nothing. The firing of James Comey and all the aftermath that suggests that the president has obstructed justice because he's exercising his power as the president of the United States, I just don't see it." And then he went on to tweet, "Thank you to Ken Starr, former independent counsel at Whitewater, for your insight and powerful words on FISA abuse, Russian meddling, et cetera. Really great interview with Maria Bartiromo." So when that happens—
I had not read that. I was made aware of it, but I never read that tweet. So
first of all, that was 7 months ago. It was February.
Yeah.
Is that still where your mindset is about everything?
In terms of obstruction of justice. And I think, frankly, the obstruction of justice arguments are going by the wayside because of not whether you say, well, I don't like his firing of James Comey, or I don't like that he did this and did that, et cetera. But the problem with this, whether you like it or not, that's not the law. So I think the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of caution generally in interpreting the criminal laws. I don't like dragnet laws that infringe upon our culture of liberty. If you're going to make something a crime, make it very specific, Congress or state legislature. And the obstruction of justice statute can be interpreted very broadly, but the Supreme Court said no. And this was not a 5-4 cliffhanger. This was 9-0.
9-0, which of course includes whatever ideological stripe you are, right?
That's everybody. Exactly. It shows that the Supreme Court and Congress can change the law and broaden obstruction of justice, but that the Supreme Court believes that there must be, quote, a corrupt element. And, you know, that's sounding in bribery as opposed to, I don't like Jim Comey and he's investigating me. I want him to go away, so I'll fire him. Well, you can say that's not very admirable. The House of Representatives can say that's really not admirable, but that's the remedy that we have, as opposed to expanding the interpretation of criminal law.
So it sounds like you don't have push notifications on your phone for every time President Trump tweets. So you didn't see that until afterwards.
I have said more than once, I wish the president would tweet to his heart's content, but would improve the quality of the tweets and stop the attacks on different people, including his own attorney general.
Were you glad that he was watching what you had to say?
I haven't thought about whether I was glad or not. No, and I've not been invited to the White House. I've not been invited to Mar-a-Lago. So I was not angling for an invitation to enter the palace, either in Palm Beach or in Washington, D.C.
There was some question as the president's put together his legal team of whether he would reach out to you or whether you would make sense as part of it. But it sounds like that would not be of interest to you.
I never discuss my conversations with the president, but I can say I've had no conversations with the president about that possibility. Oh, if he did, I would really want to have a conversation because it's a fascinating set of circumstances, and I love the practice of law. But that having been said, I'm more at home in the Supreme Court of the United States than I am in the Old Bailey, so to speak. But one of the issues is, will the president follow legal advice? And perhaps he is. And I know there are certain lawyers who I respect who resigned. So I think that would be an issue. Because I would not want to take on a representation with a reasonably foreseeable that the advice would not be followed. And then
that's something
resign.
That some of the president's lawyers seem to be complaining about, right?
Yeah.
Some of the president's former lawyers, I guess we should
yeah.
say.
And clients don't always follow your advice. So you have to make a judgment. Can I continue in the representation? So I'd weigh all that into account. But I have great respect for the presidency. And so if the person who occupies the office said through a Don McGahn, his White House counsel, or through the existing legal team, Rudy Giuliani or whatever, we need to have a talk, I would say, I'm honored. Let's have a talk.
What do you think of Rudy Giuliani as a lawyer?
I love Rudy Giuliani. I served with him. I disagree with some of the tactics being used. I mean, especially the attack the prosecutor, but that's straight out of the playbook. It's straight out of the Clinton playbook, as I describe in the book.
Right. And that's there is a very much parallel situation in that the Clinton White House went after you, went after the entire process going on in a similar way to how the Trump White House has approached this, and certainly how Rudy Giuliani, who does seem like a lot of what he is doing is serving as the legal spokesman for the president here. And he's talked about how he's been very open that he thinks this is a question about whether we're going to impeach the president at some point, and that's a political question. And so he's doing a political job by going on TV and making the comments that he's made to sort of undermine the investigation.
That may be right. I would simply say I'm from the old school. You try to address issues on the merits, and especially when the client is the president of the United States, there's an additional obligation to abide by the rule of law. And that's one of the things that I point out, that President Clinton was more skillful about attacking and demonizing the prosecutor, but he was able to do so at key moments, including with Susan McDougal. I tell that story, and we believe he got word to her that he would pardon her. That's not an obstruction of justice, but it is an abuse of power. So that's the way I read the evidence. President Clinton may have a different view. He didn't address that specifically, as I recall, in my life, but I wanted this record to show that one of the reasons that we did not bring charges in Arkansas against either Clinton is because we simply lacked the evidence that as a matter of ethics and professional responsibility that we could prove up beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of their financial crimes. We believe they both committed or were involved in financial crimes.
And that's always the weird thing for it seems like for a prosecutor who's in the middle of it and then dealing with people who don't know the full picture of what's going on, that you may agree with people that there is something there, but for you it becomes a question of can you prove it? Can you get a conviction off of it?
That's exactly right. And the ethical prosecutor, and we tried to be, and I believe we were, entirely ethical in our dealings. And one of the things that I describe in the book is that because of the nature of the independent counsel, I wanted additional guardrails to guard against abuse of power. I knew those charges would likely come unless we were able to wrap it up in 6 months.
So what is that experience like when you are the one who's being attacked? You were doing, as you see it, as you saw it then, you see it now, is doing your job, going through this very carefully, very ethically. And meanwhile, at the time, not only was James Carville going after you from the Clinton White House, but, you know, Maureen Dowd was writing about how you were a sex maniac. You were a very, very famous name. You were a very famous person at that point, and not for
not
the most
the
part because the people were applauding you. And you have to show up to work every day and try to do this. What is that?
It's miserable. And the point came home in the throes of the Lewinsky phase of the investigation when someone walks in the door. I had an open door policy. Just come in. Any colleague was welcome to come in and share what was on his or her mind. Anyway, someone comes in and said, "Hey, Ken, guess what? Your numbers are now below those of Saddam Hussein." So the Clinton White House, with its what Howie Kurtz, then of the Washington Post, called the spin cycle, the spins, and every White House has a spin machine, propaganda machine. Theirs was really good, and it was worked relentlessly. And so what was it like? It was it brought home the fact that some jobs are just absolutely miserable and you just have to get through it and encourage the team. So I tried very hard not to be demoralized, not to act depressed, even if I was demoralized and depressed, but to keep walking on the sunny side of the street. I would use the metaphor, David Reisman, the late great sociologist from Harvard, use the metaphor for America of the children's book, The Little Engine That Could. Mm-hmm. So you just say, I think again, I know I can, and I know we can do this. It's just, it's going to be a really tough slog through a terrible quagmire. And as I say, I complained that we did not have then the moral support of the Justice Department. And that was a deep disappointment to me as someone who then is now loves the Department of Justice.
And where you'd spent years before you were in the job as the independent prosecutor.
I'd served as chief of staff to the attorney general. So I got in that context to know the entire department and have the greatest admiration for the men and women of the department, the career civil servants, lawyers and non-lawyers who served there. And then I was privileged to serve as solicitor general. But I also, in that context, would from time to time serve as the acting attorney general when there were recusals or absences and so forth. So I knew the department. I knew its traditions. I loved the department and admired its traditions greatly.
It seems like there would be times when you would show up to you would start working on something and the people would know already, oh, it's Ken Starr, that affects some of the work that you can do, right? And in the same way that now I assume when people find out that Bob Mueller is interested in them, they come into it with a number of preconceived notions of what it's going to be and what he's going to be looking for, even if they don't know for sure what that is.
Yeah, I would describe it somewhat differently, but if you're talking about those who we say we have an interest in what you're doing, my situation—
Like, for example, when you describe when Monica Lewinsky came into your life directly,
yes,
right? And
yes,
she immediately knew who you were, what was happening,
right,
and
yes,
reacted as though she was not going to be the one to take down the president. She knew what you wanted her for.
Yes.
Right?
No, that we wanted to know the facts. It is right. Just that what's the truth? We would frequently say to witnesses when they were making a decision whether to cooperate with the investigation or not, we can deal with the truth, whatever it is. What we cannot deal with are lies. And so that's what we wanted from Monica. That's what we wanted from everyone. It also pointed to the broader attitude, as I saw it, that both Clintons had with respect to the rule of law, the rules of the game. They don't apply to us. We do what we want to do, and we will attack and vilify anyone who tries to call us into account. So we said to Monica, you know, we want your cooperation, but you're absolutely right. As I recount, I don't think this has ever been reported, that she goes out into the hall with her mother at the Ritz-Carlton in Pentagon City and using pretty vile language, in the face of her mother asking her to cooperate, get this behind you, she used very vile language to say she was not going to bring this, and then lots of expletives, down. So Monica was extremely clever. I think we now know she's very articulate, very intelligent, obviously a very attractive young woman, recently out of college at the time. But she showed a fierce determination to be loyal to President Clinton.
And there's this moment that you describe in there of her going, taking a walk and going to a payphone and whispering Hoover yes. into the Betty Curry, the Clinton's secretary, into her answer machine. She was trying to warn that the FBI, Hoover was J. Edgar Hoover.
It was very clever. It didn't work for whatever reason. I don't think we ever determined whether Betty heard that message, Betty Curry heard that message. But that was a smart move on her part, right? She didn't know whether she was being monitored or whatever. We were not. She had freedom of movement.
Was it your sense that that was like a prearranged code or?
No, I don't think so. And I don't remember our asking Monica that question. I just think that was a fairly clever way to say the police are here, the cops are
on the beat. Yeah, I've never been in a situation where I've warned somebody about the cops coming or the FBI, but I'm not sure that I would have come to the thought of saying Hoover into a phone.
Yeah, but I viewed it as, of course, after the fact, as clever. You know, instead of saying FBI, I'm under, and she was not under arrest, but I'm under very difficult circumstances here, and they're wanting me to cooperate and all that. She just, one word, you know, sort of mayday, right. Mayday.
Well, that one maybe would have made more sense. but as you're doing this, also, there are all these conspiracy theories that start to set in because people don't know what a prosecutor is doing often, right? And in this situation, that was going on. Again, we see that happening now with the Mueller probe, where every couple of weeks or maybe more than that or maybe less than that, we get something out of the Mueller probe and we don't know when it's coming. I think remarkably, they don't leak at all still. And every time that there's been an indictment that's come out, reporters 90 minutes before won't know that something is happening. I'd say that as a reporter who's been in newsrooms, talked to other reporters in other newsrooms. But when you see those conspiracy theories, when you saw them popping up around what you were doing, does it make you just want to wave your arms and say, no, that's not, it's not that.
Yeah, you feel frustrated. There's no question. I think Bob Mueller enjoys, shall I say, a reservoir of support, including on the Republican side in Congress. I'm not saying universally. He has his critics, et cetera.
You know him?
But I do, and I have great confidence in him and his integrity. I have expressed concern about some of the people around him, given some of the things that they have done in the past. It's not simply the partisanship.
Have you had any conversations with him since he got?
No. The last time I saw him, he was just stepping down from the FBI. We did, in fact, serve alongside one another. So I've been in any number of meetings with Bob Mueller when he was the head of the criminal division at the Justice Department.
Yeah, I mean, both of you are sort of people who spent most of your careers around the Justice Department or in the Justice Department.
In and around, yeah.
John Dean did the podcast at this point almost a year ago. And one of the things that I asked him was the difference of now when we look back at Watergate, it's a done historical thing. But when you're living through it day to day, you don't know when it's going to end. You don't know what point you are, what the thing that's going to be the most important is. What was that experience like for you?
I would use the word frustrating. I had not expected for the investigation that I inherited to be multifaceted. I was stunned to hear on the very first day that I was in Little Rock. I'd flown there after taking the oath of office in the early afternoon. And so late afternoon, I'm in Little Rock, Arkansas, on a commercial flight, flying coach, by the way. And so I show up and here's all these reporters around. I describe the scene, which was just a reminder, oh my goodness, this is highly visible. The investigation of the president is something that is of keen public interest. But he said, Ken, move your family to Little Rock. You're going to be here for a long time. So the when will it end became an irrelevant question because it was, there's a lot to be done. So think of flood cleanup. Is this going to be done in a few days? No, right? It's going to take
still
a long
years
time.
And years. And when you're 2 years in, do you think, okay, well, it's got to be 6 months of this left and then we'll be able to wrap
it up?
No,
I stopped putting a time frame on it. It was just, let's get the job done. It's step by step. But again, we had different aspects of the investigation on the way. So here's a criminal prosecution that I inherited, criminal investigation, which resulted in a prosecution. into campaign finance violations in the 1990 right. gubernatorial campaign of Bill Clinton. So
and then ended with Monica Lewinsky, which is, has often been invoked as a cautionary tale, essentially, of thinking where Bob Mueller will end up is not necessarily close to where he started. When you took that oath of office, there was no thought in your mind, I assume, of I'm going to be looking into the sex life of the president.
No. Oh, my word.
Right.
Who would have thought anything like that?
Do you think that Bob Mueller should put out a report when he's done?
Well, under the regulations, there will be a reporting mechanism to the Deputy Attorney General.
Should it be public, I guess, is the question.
My answer to that is I trust the judgment of Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, but I think there is such a cry for knowing the answer to the initial question, was there collusion in the campaign, that it would be a useful public service.
What's your current state of mind on whether President Trump should sit down with him, with Mueller?
Well, I have there are two perspectives. If I'm on his criminal defense team, I would be very concerned.
Why?
First of all, I don't know what President Trump knows, but there have been a number of guilty pleas. Some of those guilty pleas go to false statements. So I would just be cautious with respect to the president's duty. The other perspective that I have is he is the president of the United States, and I think that carries with it an obligation to cooperate with duly authorized federal investigations.
So essentially, he has an obligation to do something you think will put him into a troublesome situation.
That could. But there are two perspectives. So if I'm in the role of a criminal defense lawyer, I'm sounding notes of caution the way that Rudy Giuliani and others are sounding. Yet at the same time, there seems to be an attitude of, you know, let's have a conversation. We've never told you to go pound sand, Mr. Mueller. So let's stay in dialogue about it. Written Q's and A's and so forth. So it's a negotiation process, just as I describe our negotiation process with President Clinton and his very able lawyers in terms of his grand jury appearance in August, when we all hoped that he would finally tell the truth, stop lying, and just come clean, settle the case. In fact, he did settle the case, the Paula Corbin Jones case, you know, shortly after all this, before the House impeachment process began. I wish he had done that a few years earlier.
Do you think he can fire Mueller?
Yes. Yes, he clearly has, by my lights, and I don't think there's any serious dispute among constitutional lawyers and scholars that he has the raw power to direct his firing.
We've been talking a lot about President Trump and the, sort of the white water investigation in the background. I want to just bring a couple of questions about you and the Clintons directly. One of the things that struck me in the book is you seem somewhat enamored of Bill Clinton's political talents.
Absolutely. First in his class, I've draw from David Marinus, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, the biography. He was first in his class. And Bill Clinton reminds me of Lyndon Baines Johnson. LBJ was not that charismatic, but he's extremely effective as a leader. The Senate Majority Leader, he was extremely effective at getting things through. And then early on, he was a very successful president, and the tragedy, of course, was Vietnam, not scandal. Bill allowed himself to have his reputation tarnished because of, notwithstanding all these gifts, because of his, I guess, excessive self-confidence that he could lie his way out of it. I could just charm my way out of it. If he had just told the truth, I would have been done with the Whitewater investigation with all those criminal convictions. And I don't boast about that, but just when people say, and this is one of the reasons I was moved to write the book, you found nothing in Arkansas, and I said, excuse me, the sitting governor of the state and the president's and the first lady's business partners were convicted of felony offenses after a 3-month trial in a federal district court.
That's a pretty big fish.
Yeah. And so you can imagine the frustration that, and I hear that as recently too, you didn't find anything in Arkansas. And so you then went after the president on a morality quest, all of which is just, I now call it willful blindness.
Yeah.
People just say, I don't want to know the facts. And by the way, in light of the impeachment controversy now swirling around, my words of caution about impeachment, having lived through, including having to testify at the impeachment hearings for the House Judiciary Committee, is don't go there. Just don't go there. Find some other mechanism. I mean, unless obviously the circumstances warrant, but there should be a pretty heavy presumption against using the impeachment mechanism And I think wise, more senior people on the Democratic side of the aisle, including I saw a statement recently by Nancy Pelosi, who may become Speaker of the House again, who knows, saying no. And she used a great word that really captured it. Impeachment is divisive. People are just going to start lining up. Whereas if we can find some kind of common ground in the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, LBJ, come drawing from the prophet Isaiah, come let us reason together. Let's address this as opposed to this horribly raw partisanship, which comes out in impeachment.
In the book, you talk about all of your experiences doing the investigation. There are some things that you say, well, you should think about what happened at the time, decisions that you may not agree with, and sort of seeing in the bigger context. But you look, the book is called Contempt. You talk about the Clintons having a legacy of contempt. There is not the same thought of, well, understand them in the context of what was going on. So how do you see those two things lining up?
I'm not sure I followed the question.
Well, do you see if somebody would look at the Clintons and say, okay, he had an affair, but you have to think about like the circumstances of it. There were
no, this is not about the affair. It was, okay, you've now been sued for sexual harassment. That sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? You've been sued in federal district court. And so the question is, will there be fact finding? But the Clinton versus Jones, the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion, should have been a real wake-up call. You're not above the law. You think you get a timeout based upon your service as president. We respect you. You're occupying the presidency. You have a very important job. But there's no timeout. You have to respond when you're summoned to the bar of justice. That's the way I respond to all this. You have to be a rule of law person if you're going to occupy a position of trust. But frankly, I think that applies, Isaac, and just in terms of our day-to-day work as citizens, we have an obligation to do our civic duty. Oh, really? Yes. If you're summoned to testify, to serve on a grand jury, you don't have a choice. You can try to convince the judge that you shouldn't have to serve, ditto on a Pettit jury, a trial jury, but otherwise you have to serve. And the marshals can go nab you, and you know, you can be subjected to criminal penalties if you don't do your duty as a citizen. Think how weighty the duty is as a witness and a truth and justice-seeking process to raise your right hand, tell the truth, and knowingly lie.
I didn't cover the Clinton White House. I've covered the Clintons somewhat since. The argument that they tend to make effectively comes down to, well, they're using a double standard against us. Yeah, we made some mistakes, but think about what was going on and judge us fairly, and you'd understand why we did this. And that I can see by the look on your face how little patience you have for that argument.
Well, for example, you know, Hillary's sitting at the feet, figuratively speaking, of Saul Alinsky and the rules for radicals. That's the way the Clintons behaved. So if someone makes an accusation against Bill, they are, think of James Carville, trailer park trash, demeaning kinds of language. What justifies that? I don't think that would happen now. I think, as I say in the book, we're in a different place in society than we were then. But people not only tolerated it, they laughed when a Carville would mock the appearance of a Paula Corbin Jones.
You don't, I mean, isn't that what we see happening by President Trump and mocking people? And
it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrible. So I totally disapprove of that kind of behavior on the part of anyone. But all the more, but this was a co-presidency. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, this is very different. This was unique. Every first lady or first spouse has a very important role to play. But it's more civil society. She chose to exercise power and authority, including inside the White House. So the travel office firings, she directed.
Yep.
Right? And so this sense of disrespect for orderly process is something that comes through the book. And I would say President Trump would be well advised. He doesn't have time to read the book, maybe on Audible, but there's a lesson here, and that is rules count.
But this stuff means a lot to you. Do you ever think to speak out more about what you're seeing from the president, both on legal issues and sort of the morality of the presidency? And also, you value facts in a way that President Trump does not.
facts will come back to haunt you eventually. The truth ends up coming out. And so you better deal with those facts.
Right. But if you if you made it a cause of yours as saying you really value these things, these are important to you in a way that is important to you as a human being, is important to you as an American, who you are and the weight that you carry in our country, and say more frequently and more openly, the president needs to pay more attention to facts. He needs to pay more attention to what the obligations of his office bring to him.
Well, I've written op-ed pieces, including I wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that used some pretty strong language. Mm-hmm. Cut it out, Mr. President. So I have said—
Pretty direct.
So I've said in public fora. Now, I'm not a public official, but I just got invited to write an op-ed piece yesterday. So I'm glad I'm here in Washington. So I welcome those invitations. So no, I want our president to succeed. I want President Trump to succeed, but you need to help yourself. And one way to help yourself is accept orderly process unless the process needs to be reformed. If you could do it a better way, do it a better way. I heard someone say very interesting in response to, why is he treating our NATO allies the way that he is? And the response was, from his perspective, they are renters who are behind in paying the rent because of the 2%. I mean, that's an obligation, a mutual obligation. And I don't think any of our NATO allies have lived up to their obligation. They're not paying the rent. That's the way he looks at the world and is very, very direct about it. I can disagree with a particular method, but nonetheless, what's he doing is he's dealing with facts there that perhaps other more elegant presidents just choose to ignore.
So it's fast forward 2 years from now. It's 2020. You're deciding who to vote for in the presidential election. It's Donald Trump versus a Democrat, given that you were making a sort of larger philosophical judgment in 2016. Would you vote for President Trump again?
Honestly, I had to struggle with that decision in 2016, and I would struggle with it in 2020. And the reason is— Joseph Epstein, great columnist, teacher at the University of Chicago, put it very well. He agrees with about 80% of what the president does, but disagrees with virtually everything he says and the way he says it. And I'm pretty much in that camp. I agree with a lot of President Trump's policies. I applaud his appointments to the federal judiciary, which is very important to me, given my vision of what the Constitution is and the appropriate role of the judiciary. So I also know, and Isaac, this is something I think that we come to appreciate, this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times not so long ago reminds us that we elect a government. The president presides over the government. We elect indirectly Secretary of States and Secretaries of Defense. We don't know who they're going to be typically, right? We're not a parliamentary democracy. And having served in the executive branch, I knew, serving first in the Reagan administration and then under President Bush 41, that what was around the president was essentially 2,000 people, each of those 2,000 people having very significant authority over the way we live our lives and the future and prosperity of the United States of America.
But you're comfortable with that setup? People who doubt that the president of the United States should be sitting at the desk of the Oval Office, but are comfortable running the government sort of around him?
I didn't say I was comfortable. I said
but that's a better option to you than electing a Democrat.
It depends on who the Democrat is. There are Democrats who, and I, as a college kid, loved John Kennedy.
Right.
Right. But I am a Republican. I am a proud Republican. I described my own transformation from a Democrat who loved John Kennedy to, and I continued to love John Kennedy, to a pro-liberty, pro-freedom Republican by virtue of working on the Hill and sitting at the feet of the congressman who I was serving and just listening to a perspective that, frankly, I'd never heard.
I mean, it sounds like you'll vote for him. That's
it's too soon to tell. Let's wait. Let's wait and see.
I want to.
It's a great parlor game, though, and you play it very well.
It is. Well, you know, I work for Politico. I want to end talking about the president's judicial nominations. Obviously, the big one right now is Brett Kavanaugh, who is a person you've worked with, whom you know. You investigated a lot of things with him. Who's on your team? with what's going on now, what would you do as they approach the investigation into these claims that have been made about him as an investigator?
Oh, you gather all the facts, you assess the facts, and then you come to a judgment. This is, of course, going to be in a very different situation. It's not a grand jury investigation. It's not a trial. It's a public spectacle. So I welcome the recent suggestion that we go back. I don't think credit was given by Ron Klain, who came up with the suggestion in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, that there should be, don't silence the senators, but there should be professional persons, lawyers, skilled at finding facts. And let's
have them. So it's less theater politically.
So it's less theater. And we've seen that. We saw that in Iran-Contra. We saw that most famously Watergate, and then even in this conversation.
Very different from the Anita Hill hearing. Oh,
exactly. I mean, I think that is a factor, an experience counseling restraint. So the senators have been elected. They need to be heard. But I think precedent suggests the wisdom of having real fact finders.
How does this moment about looking into a woman's claims, thinking about sexuality and sexual misconduct as a factor within public life, strike you as different from how you thought about things 20 years ago, 25 years ago?
I think there's just a level of seriousness now that did not exist earlier. I mean, the very idea that someone would be politically dismissed by opinion columnists, not just political partisans, as unworthy was remarkable, that we would treat human beings that way in talking about them. So when I read some of those, and I don't go back, I did some for this, and read some of the op-ed pieces that just picked up the White House line of vitriol and dehumanizing kind of talk about people, and I believe Hillary was quite complicit. Juanita Broderick describes in elaborate and chilling detail, and she said it was chilling, her conversation in the wake of the rape. She says it was a rape.
Says it was at the campaign office that Hillary Clinton approached her.
Exactly. And if one believes Juanita, I mean, people may choose not to. But that narrative fits the meta-narrative that I saw. They are above the law, and they will simply use Saul Alinsky Rules for Radicals tactics to take out anyone. I don't mean in the physical sense. Yeah. I never bought any of the conspiracy theories, most famously about Vince Foster Jr. I didn't put any credence in any of that going in, but I said, well, we have to assess it respectfully, and let's just find out all those facts. So I think that's what will go on now.
And you'd want to hear this woman, you feel like for sure deserves to be heard. And
of course. Yeah.
You are a Brett Kavanaugh fan. You'd like him to be Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And are hoping that whatever happens in the next couple of weeks of this, the end result is that. You are not the only person to vouch for his character. There are a lot of people who have and have said, this incident doesn't seem like the Brett that we know. Not only the women who went to high school with him who signed that letter, but all through his professional life. Is that what makes you sure that this allegation can't be true? Or are you sure that this allegation is not true?
I'm sure, because I believe when Brett says it did not happen. And I believe Brett based upon my seeing him. So, you know, character counts, and you kind of learn pretty quickly what a person's character is when you're in the trenches with them, right? Day in and day out. And for me, year in and year out, whether people like his jurisprudence or not, we're talking about something different. We're talking about his character as a human being. And when you look at that life of character, this is not an allegation coming out of Yale College. Yeah, Yale College, they have fun at Yale. And I'm sure sometimes the fun, it turns into something that it should not have turned into. At Yale Law School, they still have fun. I know the Yale Law School. They have a lot of fun, but certain things shouldn't happen, right? None of his experiences as a college student, as a law student, and then his exemplary career over these years in Washington, D.C., decades, gives the slightest hint that he would have been the person. So is it mistaken identity? I don't know.
All right. It seems like a decent place to leave it. Ken Starr, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Isaac.
So what do you think? Was that a satisfying account from him of his approach? What did you make of what he said about President Trump and the legal advice he would have for him? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. And while you're at it,
Make sure to follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing, as always. These episodes wouldn't be getting to you without him. And catch you next time on Off Message.